being the Supreme Court of the state of Wisconsin. And in this program, students from all the high schools in the state are invited to join us for oral argument and then have a presentation by one of the justices of this court at noon. And the students have received written materials about this case and may have met with attorneys and others to discuss the case they're about to hear. So we're delighted to have you with us today. Now let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. And Justice Crooks is the justice with whom you will meet today. Seated to my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And to my right is Justice William Babbage, and to his right, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. So that's our lineup for today. You and the court. So we will hear our first case, 00-1886-CR State v. Paul. Is it Hoppe or Hoppe?
Hoppe.
State versus Paul Hoppe. And arguing and representing the state of Wisconsin is James M. Freiman. Mr. Freiman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state as petitioner in this criminal case. This case is in a pretrial posture. Defendant Paul Hoppe stands charged with first-degree reckless homicide. On or about Friday, March 5th, 1999, Mr. Hoppe, then age 49, allegedly caused the beating death of his girlfriend Jackie Simon, age 57. At 6 p.m. on Saturday, March 6th, the next day, police found Jackie's body on the floor of Mr. Hoppe's Portage apartment. Mr. Hoppe was seated on an adjacent couch. Later that night, that same night, March 6th, Mr. Hoppe was admitted to a hospital with symptoms of alcohol withdrawal. Police Captain Kenneth Manthe interviewed Mr. Hoppe for 1 hour that night, which was early Sunday morning, March 7th. And for 2 hours on each of the next 2 days, March 8th and 9th. These sessions were audio taped and transcribed and are part of the appellate record. The trial court ruled that Mr. Hoppe's statements during his interviews are inadmissible as involuntary, calling it a very difficult issue. The Court of Appeals agreed, concluding that in light of Mr. Hoppe's weakened mental state, the pressures brought to bear on him by police exceeded his ability to resist. The state asked this court to reverse the Court of Appeals' legal conclusion of involuntariness.
Is there any question in the state's mind, after I've gone over the record, that Mr. Hoppe was not vulnerable and susceptible to perhaps leading questions in all three interviews that took place in the hospital? Is there any question after reading the record?
I think there's, from the defense experts, there's probably enough evidence to conclude that Mr. Hoppe at least was susceptible to some suggestion. Whether or not what the police officers did throughout the interview process were enough to either cause problems or affect that susceptibility in any way.
Go ahead. The standard is, I see it in Clappis and in the Conley case, is the police methodology. What did the police do? Did they misuse their powers in the sense of were they coercive here?
Right. And the state's position, of course, is that they are not. And I think the difficult question here is that voluntariness is a totality test, and the law is clear that you balance the suspect's personal characteristics against what the police did. Because it's a totality test, bright line rules generally aren't feasible. However, because it's also a legal question, each case effectively articulates a voluntariness rule based on the constellation of factors involved in that case. Such case-made rules are important not only to guide courts, but since the focus is on what law enforcement did or did not do, it's important, I think, to enlighten law enforcement officers on what is constitutionally permissible when they confront suspects in a variety of situations. What the state would ask this court to hold is as follows. In the case of a non-custodial suspect with apparent mental impairment, like Mr. Hoppe, this court should hold that the suspect's statements elicited by police questioning are voluntary, and that means admissible in the state's case in chief at trial, if three criteria are part of the totality of the circumstances. Those criteria are, if, objectively on the record as a whole, the suspect appeared to sufficiently understand the questions posed. If, objectively on the record as a whole, the suspect appeared to sufficiently understand the meaning and possible consequences of his or her responses to those questions. And finally, and where the focus should have been, I think, on this case primarily is, if the police did nothing amounting to a clear exploitation of any obvious mental impairment of the suspect to elicit the statements.
And do you need all three? Disjunctive or conjunctive?
I would say these are conjunctive requirements, and certainly you cannot have police misconduct that overcomes the suspect's given the characteristics.
Let's just say that police just have a excellent, fair, non-coercive, not too many hours, they feed him, etc. Everything's hunky-dory. No maltreatment. But the suspect does not, conclusion is objectively, looking at the record, he doesn't seem to understand. That would be a non-voluntary. Is that right?
Under the well, I think this is part of the difficult problem.
That's why I'm pressing.
I think what's difficult is the case law is clear from Colorado versus Connolly that even if a person is irrational, totally irrational, that doesn't preclude obtaining a voluntary admissible statement from that person. That there's no blanket rule that says somebody is automatically legally incompetent to give statements, voluntary statements to police. But the tricky part is when you have somebody who has apparently, and I say apparently because we're talking about the police perceptive here, perspective, how do you determine what is and isn't permissible depending on those characteristics? And the reason I use the words here that I didn't in the brief, I use the words appeared to understand rather than understood, because I think that better captures our position in accordance with the law that questioning officers should not be required to consult, much less to rely on, medical opinions about a person's competency to voluntarily give statements.
Well, here, in this case, we had expert testimony, I believe, from Dr. Hayes, and then the psychologist that visited him while he was in the hospital on the 8th of March. And it's known that Mr. Hoppe was an alcoholic. He was in the state of alcohol withdrawal, and that he was having and exhibiting these symptoms. I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, that's a given here because he had a long history of it.
And the court made factual findings to that extent.
And that's what the trial judge found, that he was in a state of alcohol withdrawal, and then he was on Librium, which when I looked Librium, which perhaps caused some of the difficulties, at least in the second or maybe the
right. The Librium wasn't started, as I understand it, until the second interview. And according to the medical experts, Librium can cause confusion and lethargy in a person.
Let me read this question. Do you have to have police misconduct in order to get to say that this is an involuntary confession?
Yes, to violate the Constitution.
Why do you need the other two?
The other two are a way of informing, I believe, both courts and officers as to what it gives some baseline, some reference point on what they need to be able to do or should do or shouldn't do when they confront a suspect who may, on the face of it, have some mental difficulties. I think Connolly is a real instructive case in this regard. And if I could, I'll turn quickly just to the facts of that case.
Before you do that, would you address for me the significance of the voice stress test? I'm wondering how that relates near to police misconduct, because as I understand it, what they told Mr. Hoppe in this situation was the voice stress test shows you're lying. Apparently, there's a real question about the reliability of stress tests like that. So how does that enter into this idea of police misconduct?
The state's position is that the first interview, which was the interview when the voice stress test was given to Mr. Hoppe, that his statements should not be admissible from that interview. And that's based on the analogy to the polygraph rule in Wisconsin. There's a ban on polygraph evidence. And by virtue of the statutory privilege that a person does not have to disclose communications made during such a test. The state's position is, and based on the law that deals with polygraphs, that if there's a sufficient distinct attenuation, a break in time, a break in content, that subsequent statements are admissible. And in this particular case, and there's two ways of approaching it. One is there's a statutory concern, which is one argument. But for purposes of voluntariness, there's also that issue of whether that whether that information from the first test, whether that conduct carried over in some way that was coercive. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court, in, I believe it's Weyrich is the name of the case cited in the briefs, Weyrich versus Fields, has rejected a rule that use of polygraph results in questioning is inherently coercive. And if the court would like, I can go into our attenuation analysis, if you like, on the facts. The interviews of March 8th and 9th were significantly distinct in time from the voice stress test. The interview on March 8th, which was the next one after the test, 37 hours later. And the interview on the third day was 60 hours after the test. The fact that they were in the same location, the hospital room, just happens to be due to the neutral fact that Mr. Hoppe was admitted to the hospital. Mr. Hoppe signed a consent form to take the voice stress test. He was told there would be no trick questions. And although he was told that his answers were deceptive, that he was being deceptive, Mr. Hoppe even reiterated at that time that he did nothing wrong, that he didn't harm his girlfriend, Jackie. So even immediately after the test, when the detective was conveying the results, if you will, it did not compel Mr. Hoppe to make any incriminating statements. Thereafter, Captain Manthe never suggested to Mr. Hoppe that the test results were infallible or admissible in evidence. And when he interviewed Mr. Hoppe during those second two interviews, he did not use the test at all, didn't refer to the test, to suggest that Mr. Hoppe was lying during any of the interviews.
So you're really taking the position that there's enough attenuation here with 37 hours and 60 hours that we shouldn't be concerned about the way the voice stress test was utilized.
That's correct, and also the fact that there was no reference made to it after that point. And that even, as I say, an indicator that it wasn't coercive, it was even during that first day when the test was being administered, it didn't influence Mr. Hoppe in any way. It didn't, I mean, he acknowledged that, or he said that he didn't harm anybody based on the test.
Are you ready to get back to Connolly?
Yes, Connolly. Okay. Facts of Connolly.
Let me just ask you this about Connolly.
Sure.
The way I read Connolly, mental illness alone doesn't make a confession involuntary.
That's correct. That's how I read it.
And two, the fact that there is no police coercion, nothing bad in the statements, that alone doesn't make it voluntary, but that you have to look at the two together.
Correct.
Is that how you read Conley?
That's correct.
So you have to, that's what you mean by the totality of circumstances here. You have to look at the mental illness in what, how the police did the interrogation, even though taking away the mental illness problem, the interrogation might have just been fine. You have to look at them two together.
Correct.
To see if the two working together would lead us as a matter of law to conclude that it was involuntary or that it was voluntary.
Correct. And I think the difficult part is that the case law seems to be very minimal on discussing what, or on discussing that side of the balance that deals with the suspect's mental capacities and mental, short from saying that, it, you know, if the police don't do anything wrong, I'm short of saying that mental illness alone is enough. So what I was trying to do with these two factors that go to mental state is to try to give some additional meaning to that part of the balance. It's still a totality test. I mean, just because they're met, does it automatically mean, well, if they're met and there's no police misconduct, then I'm saying it's voluntary. But, for example, if they weren't met, it doesn't necessarily mean that they were involuntary. These are just signposts for dealing with the mental state aspect of it. The critical part, which Conley drives home, is that there has to be police misconduct that affected, given the status of the suspect, that made those coercive.
Not misconduct, but police conduct.
Well, I think it has to be coercive in the sense of that they were using it to exploit or overcome.
Coercive for this person.
Coercive for that person, correct.
Someone else might not have been
coercive. That's true.
But that's why you look at two. What did they do, and how did it affect this person?
That's right.
Recognizing this person's vulnerability.
That's correct.
Or inadequacy, or whatever.
That's
the
correct.
Words you want
and
to
I, use. And the reason I identify these two criteria, because I think it's important that in this case, if you look at the audio taped interviews and look at it in its entirety, Mr. Hoppe certainly understood that he was talking to police about the death of his girlfriend, that he understood the questions and was responding rationally, not irrationally, or appropriately, and that he understood that he could go to jail if he did something wrong, if he admitted doing something wrong. But to get back to Conley real quick, because I think it helps frame the legal analysis, if I could. In Conley, the court said a defendant enjoys no right to have statements to police admitted into evidence only where the defendant was totally rational and properly motivated. The court cautioned against making, quote, sweeping inquiries into the defendant's state of mind. In Conley, the defendant walked up to an officer, said he had murdered somebody and wanted to talk about it. He was Mirandized, said he understood his rights.
He's never asked him a question.
Not at that point.
Really voluntary.
It was, well, the approach, yes, correct. At that point it was, correct. Sure. He was Mirandized, said he understood his rights, but still wanted to talk. An interview ensued during which the defendant did not appear mentally ill to the officers. And the defendant took police to the murder site. The next morning, the defendant was visibly disoriented when talking to a defense attorney, began giving confused answers to questions, and said he heard voices telling him to confess. He was initially found incompetent for trial and then was later found competent for trial. A doctor gave the opinion that before the police questioning, at least as of the day before the police questioning, the defendant had been in a psychotic state due to schizophrenia. The doctor said the defendant was experiencing command hallucinations that interfered with the defendant's volitional abilities, the ability to make free and rational choices, which could have motivated the confession. The doctor said the illness did not significantly impair the defendant's cognitive abilities. I read Conley to mean that what counts for voluntariness is the suspect's apparent awareness that he or she is answering police questions about criminal activity with possible adverse consequences, rather than any actual pre-existing impairment of the suspect's mental capacity to rationally choose if it's a good idea to do so.
Counsel, with regard to Conley, it seems to me that Conley can be cited for the premise that the more severe the mental condition, or the more obvious the delusional or hallucinating is of the defendant, that the balance with regard to the level of improper police conduct lessons. Is that the way you read it? This is a sliding scale.
Sure.
If you're really crazy,
yeah.
And let me be irreverent in these terms. If you're really crazy, perhaps the conduct of the police that is deemed improper would not, that very same conduct would not be deemed improper if you're only just a little crazy. There's a sliding scale. Is that your way
That's
to read
it? That's my understanding too, sure. And I put out these two criteria that deal with mental state is, I think if those are present, in other words, if the suspect is capable to understand what's going on and answer rationally or not inappropriately and knows that this is a police interview that could result in adverse consequences to the person, that puts that suspect more like a person who is not having a significant disability, somebody that the police don't have to necessarily be as coddling of. It's difficult. I don't mean to. It's difficult, I think, to identify that. And if voluntariness deals with police conduct, we have to have something that tells the police what they should or shouldn't do when they're confronted with a suspect in a situation like this. If it's hard enough for a court to determine voluntariness with the benefit of deliberation and hindsight, think how difficult, much more difficult, for a police officer confronting a suspect who doesn't seem quite necessarily altogether there.
They have to take more care than they would with someone else.
That's true.
So they're on alert.
Sure. But I think where the Court of Appeals and Trial Court erred in this case is to focus so singularly, so heavily on the mental state of Mr. Hoppe as reflected in medical opinions, which I question whether, for example, competency to consent, without some explanation as what that means, it's hard to know what the medical doctor was saying. And in terms of Mr. Hayes, the psychologist, he was even reluctant to give such an opinion. And when you get further into that interview with Mr. Hayes, for example, he's asked about, was he able to understand the police questioning? And that's where he suggests that, yes, to a certain extent, he could understand the questions. He knew where he was. He knew they were talking about the death of his, and that type of thing. So I'm suggesting that Mr. Hoppe wasn't this totally irrational person that you couldn't ask pointed questions to.
Isn't this case complicated by the fact that at times he seemed to be perfectly rational and at other times he was really out of it?
There are moments. I think that it's a fair suggestion that there are moments that it appeared that he either didn't understand the question, he wasn't really clear about maybe what was going on. That's what makes this difficult in part. He was being given Librium, and that, I think, is certainly a key factor in contributing perhaps to the confusion and the lethargy, apart from medical diagnosis about the alcohol-induced dementia and confabulation and that sort of thing. But again, I think where I'm trying to get the court to steer back to is the police conduct here. And I find it very difficult, even with the two decisions now from the trial court and court of appeals, to identify what police did wrong. And if you go through all the findings of fact by the trial court, and I see my time is running short here, so I won't do that at this point, but if you go through all the findings of fact by the trial court, and I think I enumerated them more precisely in my reply brief, the trial court basically found that the police really didn't do anything wrong.
Your test, Mr. Counsel, first of all, it seems to me that you are
saying that the test, both under Connolly and under Clapps, is totality of circumstances.
Sure.
And that just a because you make a finding that there's, I mean, a finding of no improper police conduct does not end the inquiry. Okay, so we get that straight. What do you do? So your first two factors are determining whether or not the suspect appeared to understand this as a whole, and then whether or not he seemed to understand the meaning and the consequences. What do you do with the findings of fact by the trial court with respect to those?
I think the trial court's findings, historical facts, certainly in recounting what the medical experts, for example, said, was accurate. Where I think the trial court erred is in relying so heavily on them and without, as I said, without fleshing out what the psychiatrist meant or the psychologist meant when he was saying consent to questioning. It's not illegal. I mean, it's a difficult proposition. What does that mean? And what I'm trying to do is give some meaning to that by looking at these criteria, looking at if this person really understood what was going on in this interview, these medical criteria shouldn't be the focus of the analysis of voluntariness.
Wasn't this case, or do you think this case is unique in the sense that here, if I understand the facts, we had a psychologist who was already interviewing the defendant on the 8th of March. In other words, we had one expert who just, you know, looked at the record, but we had someone there who was observing Mr. Hoppe during this process.
It's a little unique. I mean, he's in the hospital, so there is that circumstance that makes it not like a person out on the street. There's so many I think the trial court and court of appeals rely too heavily on those opinions without considering the entire record. For example, something that's not really spelled out specifically in the record, but presumably Mr. Hoppe consented to the medical treatment while he was in the hospital, or at least was competent to do so. He did give consent to a search warrant that is not challenged. So my point of contention is with the degree of weight that the trial court and court of appeals placed on that without really looking at the entire record as a whole.
Well, and I think Justice Babbage raised that, you know, it's clearly we would have to find, I suppose, that it would be a trial court, we don't disturb that unless it's, quote, clearly erroneous. In other words,
that's true. The fact finding, correct, yes. One aspect of this also I think that's important is, you know, the focus on voluntary has to be on what the police did wrong, and I would ask the court at least to provide some guidance to law enforcement officers how they should behave in this situation.
What would you suggest here? Now, as Justice Babbage and Justice Wilcox point out, this is not somebody who's in the police station or at home. He's in a hospital. There's a nurse with him, right? She gives him, and I assume under doctor's orders, gives him medication, right?
Yes.
And then he is visited by a doctor, Frederick Bronson, right, who treats him. And so you've got Bronson. He's then comes a psychologist comes in.
Who called the psychologist? I don't know. I don't think it's
hospital care, probably for,
sure,
because he has experience in treating alcoholics, right? So he sees
right.
him.
Correct.
So it's not the usual record you get with 4 or 5 or 10 or 1 police officer testifying as to what happened and what was the condition of the defendant.
Sure.
You've got him in a hospital. And so now here, when you got him in the hospital, could the police have asked the doctors?
That's one of my concerns, is that I don't think they were required to do so, nor if they did so, did they have to rely on it. Suppose they had. Suppose, rather than hearing this in court, the officer heard it from the doctor or the psychologist right there. Does that mean that they couldn't elicit admissible statements doing what they did? I don't think so. I mean, that's our position, that Captain Matthew behaved in a way that gave solicitation, understood this circumstances of this person's condition and acted accordingly. He did not...
He didn't have to go to the doctors. He didn't have to check the medical chart. He could, knowing the guy's in the hospital, knowing he's an alcoholic, knowing that there are obviously withdrawal symptoms, nevertheless proceed. But he proceeds at his own risk.
I think so. I mean, correct. And in this case, certainly there was an investigation, at least on the first day. Nobody knew exactly what had happened, if anybody was. So there's an investigation aspect to this, apart from the elicitation of admissible evidence. But
if the trial court considers the physician's, the medical report, which is done instantaneously, I mean simultaneously with this, and the police, do you have any difficulty with that? And then the court says that they think it's voluntary, involuntary, you don't keep it. That's okay.
No, expert testimony on this is certainly relevant. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the weight that was accorded to it overlooks what the real focus should be. I see my time's up.
Thank you. So it's a weight issue.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Schmall, Assistant State Public Defender representing Paul D. Hoppe.
Good morning. My name is William Schmall. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender, Appellate Division, and I represent Paul Hoppe. In my view, this is a fairly straightforward case under the voluntariness due process test, although I concede that it does have an unusual set of facts. In view of the path that the morning's comments have taken, I will devote the vast bulk of my time this morning to a discussion of what is coercion. I will offer the court a working definition of what is police coercion, and I will explain why that definition is appropriate both under settled United States Supreme Court law and common sense. However, before I get to the topic of coercion, I would ask the court to indulge me for a moment in reviewing what happened before this case arrived in the Supreme Court, because the state does seem to quarrel with the trial court's fact-finding. The trial court held evidentiary hearings on three different days, and the trial court listened firsthand to nine different witnesses testify. The trial court also personally listened to approximately 5 hours of audio tape recordings, which disclosed the police interviews with Mr. Hoppe. And after hearing and seeing all of that testimony and evidence, the trial court made credibility determinations between the live witnesses, the medical witnesses, and the persuasive value of what was on the audio tapes. The trial court also drew inferences from Mr. Hoppe's pauses in answering questions on the audio tapes, his unintelligible answers from the audio tapes, and the tone of his voice. Now, maybe the members of this court might draw different inferences if you each personally listened to those 5 hours of audio tapes. But the trial court said that he has already done that. And under settled Wisconsin law, the appellate court is not supposed to replace those inferences. So I respectfully submit that the state is indeed trying to quarrel with the trial court's findings of fact, and it is doing so inappropriately.
Are you going to list those findings of fact that you believe most telling?
Not really.
What would you please?
I think the trial court commented at length about Mr. Hoppe's medical problems, his alcohol withdrawal, the effects on his blood sugar, his short-term memory, his long-term memory, the medications that he was under, and basically concluded from that Mr. Hoppe was so susceptible to suggestion leading questions, suggested fact scenarios, that he basically was adopting or trying to conform what he was saying with what he believed the officer was wanted to hear. I really am not in a position, Your Honor, to go more into depth with what the trial court found orally today. I would refer to my brief in that respect.
I've got the trial courts in front of me, and it seems to me that the crux of your case, at least strength of your case, is that trial court's findings of fact on evidentiary matters will not be overturned absent clear error. Applying those facts to the constitutional thing, of course, is our problem. But just as applying just these findings of fact, so far you've told me that his finding of fact that he tended to adopt or conform his answer is the key. Are there any others in this record that support this finding? Because, boy, I mean, if those are the findings and you can't overturn them, you win. So it seems to me you should be prepared to give us something.
Well, as has already been mentioned, the treating psychologist testified that, in his opinion, Mr. Hoppe was confabulating, which is a word that they used to mean that he was adopting the officer's...
we're not meeting, so that's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, let me get to the notion of police coercion, and this might come back to what Your Honor has been referring to. What do we know for sure about what coercion is from the United States Supreme Court decisions? Well, we know it can be either physical or mental, and we know it can be either explicit or implicit. The court has indicated that for an individual who has a subjectively vulnerable mental or physical state, even subtle or sophisticated forms of police persuasion can be coercive. As the court has said, the blood of the accused is not the only hallmark of an unconstitutional inquisition. I think we all agree that what is coercive conduct is dependent upon the unique volitional capacity of the given suspect. Of course, also the nature of the police conduct comes into play, as does the environment. And therefore, I agree with the Attorney General that there is no bright line rule that we can make. I differ a little bit from the Attorney General in that I believe volitional capacity has two dimensions. Not just rational intellect, whether one understands questions that one's being asked and can give coherent answers. I think there's also a question of freedom of choice, freedom of will. For example, if you were to put me on the torture rack and ask me whether I can kidnap the Lindbergh baby, there's a good chance that I would say yes, that I would understand the meaning of the questions, I would understand the consequences of my answer, but that would not be voluntary. And I should say as an aside that I had not even been born yet at the time of that crime. So I think what we're talking about with volitional capacity is not just being coherent and rational, but also having the freedom of will. We also know from the Supreme Court cases that some coercive police conduct may occur without necessarily resulting in a finding of an involuntary statement. The court said so in Colorado versus Connolly at footnote 2. In other words, coercive police conduct is not in and of itself equivalent to an involuntary statement. Conversely, that would also imply that a statement that it was found to be voluntary does not necessarily imply that no coercive police conduct occurred. So, what I come around to is this. I missed one point. Excuse me. The court has said in a case called Townsend versus Sane which is cited in my written brief, and I'm going to refer to it during my remarks this morning. The court has indicated that police conduct is coercive if it overrides the suspect's volitional capacity in fact, regardless of whether the police acted in good faith and without improper motivations. And that's at pages 308 and 309 of the official reporter for Townsend versus Saint. So when we use terms like police misconduct, police overreaching, police exploitation of the suspect.
Just to interrupt you for a minute, here it seems to me it's hard to pinpoint police misconduct. I think overreaching, as I read the transcript, when do you find it overreaching when they conducted three interviews and they were all in, quote, the hospital setting, or is it asked by one of the justices, Justice Crooks, as far as the having the voice, the stress on the first interview and then coming back to that, but if you read this somewhat indirectly in the second or third transcript as far as his veracity or what really happened, is that overreaching or is that misconduct?
I would say that those are both factors, individual factors that go into the totality of circumstances that represent overreaching, yes. I do plan to list what I believe are all of the factors as soon as I've completed my definition of what coercion is. Let me suggest to the court that when Townsend versus Sane said that police good faith is not relevant, that is a matter of common sense. The suspect is not a mind reader. The suspect cannot be expected to divine the officer's motivation any more than the officer in Colorado versus Connolly could be expected to divine that particular individual's mental state. And I thought of a far-fetched but nevertheless educational illustration that I can give you on this point. Supposing during the police interrogation, the officer swats the suspect on the side of the head with his open hand and gets a statement. And the officer then comes to the suppression hearing and says, well, I saw a mosquito land on this fellow's ear, and I believed it was a West Nile virus mosquito, and I had to act quickly. So I was really just acting for the person's own good. I still submit that that would represent one act of police coercion, although it wouldn't necessarily make the statement involuntary in and of itself. So from these factors, I arrive at what I offer to the court as a workable definition of what is police coercion, and that is as follows. Coercive police conduct for purposes of the due process voluntariness test is any act or conduct that reasonably and objectively tends to undermine or exploit this particular individual citizen's subjective volitional capacity in fact. Let me say that again. Coercive police conduct means any act or conduct that reasonably and objectively tends to undermine or exploit this particular individual's subjective volitional capacity in fact.
Doesn't that define the whole purpose of police interrogation? Isn't that the point for the police to get the person to confess?
Well, I think if a police officer is acting just to obtain a particular result, it would. I think more properly, though, police officers should be trying to get the truth.
Well, I don't quarrel with that, but the definition you have offered to us, as I was listening to it, basically defines the purpose of police interrogation, which is to exploit the person's volitional capacity in order to get him to confess. And so if we adopt this definition, we are basically saying that almost all police interrogation is unconstitutional.
Well, but if I understand your question, Your Honor, I don't think all persons that are interrogated are guilty, and therefore for them to confess, it is not the the ultimate goal.
That is the ultimate goal of police interrogation, is to gain a confession. And unless the law is overtly hostile to confessions and holds them as suspect per se or inherently, this definition is completely unworkable.
I disagree that the purpose of police interrogation is to obtain a confession as opposed to the truth. And I fundamentally disagree with you on that.
Well, you want a confession of the truth. Maybe that would compromise.
Well, that's a good point. When we use the word confession, we sometimes take that to connote that this statement is a true statement of guilt. And we know from the DNA cases around the country, for example, that false confessions do happen. So, yes, the police want the person to make a statement. That is the goal of police interrogation, is to make a statement.
A true statement. An incriminating statement that also is true. But I don't quarrel with you on that. But that's the whole point of police interrogation of a suspect.
Well, I fundamentally disagree. I think police are supposed to be impartial investigators towards the truth, not necessarily just to get a suspect to say I'm guilty.
Well, what they don't want the suspect to say, I'm innocent. I mean, that's why they got them there, right?
Well,
got them there.
Perhaps they should.
So you think the point of the interrogation is to get a statement. Let's not call it a confession, because confession might implicate that it's guilt of the particular crime. You think that they should get a statement that is a true statement about the defendant's relation to the crime. True statement might be, I wasn't there, died of natural causes, I tried to help him.
Correct.
Or, yep, my fingers were around his throat. Now, I didn't intend to kill him, but my fingers were around the throat, and I did apply pressure.
That's correct. And to do...
That's what you think the cops are supposed to do.
To obtain those statements without unduly pressuring or overriding that person's human capacity as a citizen to exercise his or her own free will.
Well, but the police can trick them. They can say, well, I got your cohort in the next room and he's pointing his finger at you and you're going to get it unless you point your finger in the right direction. That's allowed.
That might be a legitimate tactic, I would agree. Assuming that that were true.
Okay. But accepting your definition for the moment, I'm trying to see whether I agree with Justice Sykes. If you can undermine the subjective volitional capacity, then your concept is it's not voluntary. Isn't that right?
That's right. No, excuse me. That means that police act would be a coercive police act. Necessarily by itself result in an involuntary statement.
What else do you need?
Well, you have to look at all of the other police conduct, as well as the individual person's subjective impairments and vulnerabilities.
How many times the guy's been before cops before?
Certainly.
His knowledge of all of this?
Certainly.
Look at that. So something that might be coercive to me might not be coercive to somebody else.
Absolutely. I promised to offer some of what I believe are the coercive police acts in this case, since that seems to be the state's real question. And I would suggest that, first of all, the mere fact of questioning this fellow, when the police either knew or should have known, reasonably should have known, that his physical and mental capacity was substantially impaired is in and of itself something that was an exploitive or coercive police act.
Doesn't that fly in the face of the existing case law then? If I mean, nobody, for heaven, well, I was thinking in the Clappies case or in the Conley case, you can interrogate or talk to people that have certainly, how would that affect people that have accidents and go to the hospital? You're saying, well, they knew he or she's in a vulnerable position. Is that what's unusual about this case that isn't in some of those other cases where they allow that interrogation?
Well, what's unusual is the degree of Mr. Hoppe's impairment as compared with what appeared to be coherent patients in the hospital in Clappies. I refer the court at this time to Townsend versus Sane, which I mentioned a moment ago.
Just as Bradley, before you go to Townsend, and before you're telling me what you think are the coercive acts, and my response is, let's look at what the trial judge thought were the coercive acts, because this court is going to review those findings, not your arguments as to what may or may not constitute coercion. You were just discussing, and I refer to page 148 of the appendix. One of the findings the trial court made with regard to what you were just saying is, it's all law enforcement seemed to be insensitive to the very obvious impairments being demonstrated by Mr. Hoppe during the course of the questioning. That was a finding of the trial court. That is exactly what you're arguing, as I understand it, that they weren't sensitive to his degree of incapacity. The trial court goes on to make another finding. By reason of his impairment, the defendant was particularly susceptible to the techniques used in questioning, including the suggestions of fact scenarios surrounding the death of Jackie Simon. That's another finding. Court concludes, while these techniques under different circumstances might not be considered oppressive, they reach a different level because of the circumstances under which the questioning occurred and because of the characteristics being demonstrated by Mr. Hoppe. That's a conclusion. The prior page as to other findings, the court found on Appendix 147, over the course of the three interviews, the questioning of the defendant became more and more Corsica.
Yeah.
Which I assume it means coercive, and accusative. There's another finding. There was an increase in the use of psychological pressure by using emotional topics such as the death of the defendant's parents, the concerns of the family of the deceased, prior military experience, and service in Vietnam. Are there any other findings of the trial court, besides not having Miranda warnings, which is on the same page, that you could point to that are findings of acts which you would assert undermine this defendant's volitional capacity?
Well, what you're asking is to look at the trial court's explicit findings of fact.
That's exactly what I'm looking
for. And as I understand the standard of review in this court, the rule is that the trial court is not required to recite magic words in setting forth its findings, and that when it does not expressly make a finding to support its legal conclusion, the appellate court should assume that the trial court made the finding if the record contains facts to support it.
Counsel, I am not of the belief that this trial court has to say, I hereby find A, additionally I find B, moreover I find C. I read pages 147 and 148, as I just did, as trial court findings regarding the conduct of the police. You apparently don't, huh? Or do you? I'm asking.
No, I think they're findings, but I don't think they necessarily represent the universe of facts in the record to support the trial court's conclusion. I was about to get into that. I don't mean to sidestep what you're asking me, though.
Why are you fighting the trial court? He found that Hoppy was very, I'm reading from 146, very vulnerable and very susceptible. And he noted his physical and mental conditions previously. He had significant impairments throughout the relevant time. Many of these impairments were open and obvious to law enforcement officers. Although the defendant was sometimes quite direct in his answers, one need only listen to the audio tapes to note the impairment referred to by the doctors that testified regarding Mr. Hoppy's mental and physical condition. You should be supportive of that.
I am.
Okay. Now, you've got a problem, though. If you look at the prior page, 145. Here, there were no threats. No force was used, nor was it threatened. There was no explicit intimidation, except for the initial request to withhold the first administration of medication. There was no threat to withdraw medical treatment. There was no withholding of food or water. In fact, Detective Manthe appears to be uncommonly helpful to the defendant during the course of the interviews. No promises were made except for noting cooperation to the DA. Listening to the audio tapes in this case, the tone and manner of the questioning was not harsh. I note, however, that the questioning became much more direct and accusatory in the last of the three interviews. Notwithstanding the absence of conduct, which would clearly be overreaching, now I would view that as a question of law, that whether it's this amounts to overreaching, but let's forget that for the moment. Hoppy was very vulnerable and susceptible, and then he goes on. Now, when I questioned the state's position was, even if there was no police coercion, that does not make the statement voluntary. State's position was that you had to look at the police conduct in relation to this person's mental illness. And that was the totality of circumstances. So something that might have been fine for somebody else may not have been fine for this defendant. That's the state's position. Do you debate that? Do you disagree with that position?
As a general proposition, no. Something that would be fine for some individuals might not be fine for others. Okay.
Well, I somewhat hesitate to ask you this question, but in light of what the Chief just read to you and what Justice Bradley read to you and in light of what my understanding of the state's position is that essentially this whole question of coerciveness is a sliding scale depending upon the vulnerabilities of the defendant. In other words, a little bit of coercive technique might not be at all determinative with respect to one defendant, but to a very vulnerable defendant it might be. So what I'm going to ask you is specifically, what is the police conduct, small though it may be, that amounts to police coercion?
I have a list of 8 different items that I've been trying to get to.
Great.
And the first one was to go ahead and question a person while he is apparently, obviously, substantially impaired. And I agree that the police don't have a duty to go and consult medical advice, but the police do act at their peril if they go ahead and question in that situation where the person is obviously impaired. And I refer to Townsend versus Sane, where as best as I can discern from the record in that case, all the police did is question the person who had been administered what the court called truth serum drugs.
Well, counsel, could you just give me those eight very quickly?
Yes,
because
yes,
you're running
very
out of time, and then you can come back. And
number two, the police started the first session late in the nighttime, approximately 12 midnight, even though their first contact with Mr. Hoppe was at 6 o'clock p.m., and they continued until 1:15 a.m., thereby, in effect, taking advantage of his late-night fatigue. Number three, they questioned him behind closed doors, out of the presence even of medical personnel. Did they hold him incommunicado from medical personnel? No, but they questioned him in private. Number four, they used the computer voice stress analyzer test as leverage to impress upon Mr. Hoppe that his resistance was futile. By the way, I want to point out on that the record does not support the assumption that Mr. Hoppe's voice stress analyzer answers were in fact untruthful. All we know from the record is that is what Captain Manthe told him. Number five, the officer acted as Mr. Hoppe's friend rather than as if he was there on police business. I suggest to the court, even if the friendship was real, that criminal investigation and interrogation is serious business. It is not social activity. And the Supreme Court agrees with me that acting as a friend, whether real or feigned, is one item or one factor of coercive police activity. Number six, the officer attempted to manipulate Mr. Hoppe's own emotional experiences with death in the Vietnam War. That's similar or analogous to the so-called morgue identifications or corpse photo identifications. Number seven, the officer interrogated Mr. Hoppe on three successive days for a total of approximately 5 hours until he got what he wanted. And finally, number eight, and this is the finding that I would refer back to your honors as being the trial court's most critical finding of coercive police activity, is that the officer interrogated Mr. Hoppe by way of leading questions and suggested fact scenarios so as to take advantage, in fact, of Mr. Hoppe's obvious mental impairments. Those are the eight factors that I suggest makes this a straightforward voluntary case.
If you took these factors individually, obviously you have to look at the totality, because I was just saying, well, sure, that's what happens in most cases. And if you're talking, this is Portage, Wisconsin, it's not Chicago, and you've got a relationship here. So whether you say feigned or otherwise, when you read that transcript, as I have, they knew each other for 25 years, and I can see some of these, but as you list these, you must be saying this is the reason this is not voluntary, because it's a totality situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I do not contend that any one of these or any two of these or any three of these would in and of itself make Mr. Hoppe's statements involuntary, with the possible exception of the last one, the leading and suggested questions. But the totality of circumstances test is basically the same as when a court reviews probable cause or reasonable suspicion under the Fourth Amendment. You can say any one fact may be innocent, but when you add them up, the sum can be greater than any of the individual parts.
Do you agree with the Court of Appeals that said it was a sliding scale?
Absolutely.
You looked at both?
I'm sorry.
You looked at both the condition of the defendant and what the police had done.
Certainly. One of the other factors, my time has run out, but if I can quickly finish. The trial court did, by the way, find that Mr. Hoppe had little police experience. That was one of the other factors relating to his environment, and that he had not been given warnings about his constitutional rights to have an attorney present or not to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Before you
do your rebuttal, Mr. Friend, if I want to introduce Representative Ward, who is here with the Fort Atkinson group. And it's good having you, Representative. Mr. Framuth?
Counsel, would you clarify your what is your position with regard to, do you need both, one without the other? Do you know what I'm addressing?
The voluntariness, the coercion.
Like that maybe there's been some statements or misstatements. Give me what your position is.
Well, voluntariness is a totality, and you weigh the personal characteristics against the police conduct. We've got a fair amount of case law that deals with police conduct because certain things you can say are just automatically or pretty clearly automatically not good. We don't have much case law, as far as I can tell, on looking at the characteristics of the suspect where you don't have somebody who is what you would otherwise call your normal person. Although, and that's the difficult thing, is how to deal with that. So, go ahead.
You need both, obviously. You need both. Is that your position? You need coercive conduct and the individual characteristics of the defendant
sure,
to be
assessed.
Sure,
those are all part of it.
So you could have a defendant that is just delirious and as we have here, and hallucinating, but if there's no suggestion of improper conduct, it is not an involuntary statement. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And also, you can have horrible police misconduct, but if there's no indication, conversely, that in any way, considering the personal propensities or characteristics of the defendant, that it affected the defendant, then it's not involuntary. Is
That's
that correct?
That's correct also. Yes.
Is it right to say misconduct when it might be perfectly good conduct with Mr. A, but not with Mr. B?
Right. I think maybe misconduct
there's
is...
Connolly used the word conduct.
Conduct, right. Exactly.
And Connolly uses the phrase, I believe, coercive or improper. So that would suggest that it wouldn't have to be exclusively improper. And misconduct is maybe not the best word to use as to cover the whole gamut, but that's where I...
It's conduct in connection with this person's mental condition.
That's correct.
That would make it voluntary or involuntary.
That's correct. I think the trial court and court of appeals did a yeoman's job in this case, really looking at all the facts, really considering the case law, but where the state feels that those courts erred was in the weight assigned to the mental health expert opinions on this person's status. And before discussing the police conduct factors and responding to those that were just listed by defense counsel, as far as Mr. Hoppe's mental state, just one example of why this was not the vulnerable, frail person that the trial court and court of appeals seemed to have viewed. When asked during the second interview if he knew how Jackie died, Mr. Hoppe speculated that she may have had a heart attack. When told then that she had died from something hitting her head, Mr. Hoppe asked if police had dusted a hammer on top of the stove for fingerprints. And then he also suggested the possibility of maybe an intruder. I think he used the term dragnet, good old-fashioned dragnet. These are creative, self-generated comments of a person who understands the significance of the situation that he's in and the questions that are being asked of him. As for the police conduct, I think the trial court's findings largely support the absence, even in this circumstance where you're balancing it against the suspect's characteristics. First, as the trial court found, the police did nothing improper by not giving Miranda warnings during the second and third interviews because there's no dispute Mr. Hoppe was not in custody. Second, as the trial court found.
But the trial court did find that the absence of the Miranda warnings was relevant here.
A factor. Although I would suggest that if Mr. Hoppe was as irrational, if you will, as the trial court and court of appeals suggested, then the presence or absence of that, of Miranda warnings, still sort of begs the question about, well, would he have understood that? And if he had said, yes, I understand and I waive, would that have made that much of a difference? But it is important that had they been given, it would have helped the situation. It would have made it clear, at least, that the police told him not only was he not under arrest, but that he had the right to counsel and so forth.
But this wasn't a custody situation, so it gets tricky because I'm not sure that if he had invoked the right to counsel, they would have had to follow through. So that's why I think that is sort of a red herring. Second, as the trial court found, the police did not isolate Hoppy from anyone. Nobody was posted inside or out, no guards inside or outside the room. Visitors weren't barred. Medical personnel had free access. I think closing the door simply to facilitate privacy during the interviews was not unreasonable, as even the trial court observed. And the interviews, more no less, were audio taped. So this wasn't a secret kind of affair that was going on. The officer was trying to accomplish, preserve this record that was as to what he was doing. Third, as the trial court found, Captain Matthew did nothing improper by asking a nurse to delay a tranquilizer on the first night. The nurse agreed it wasn't medically imperative, and Mr. Hoppy Quinta believed that he had to confess to get treatment since he continued receiving care despite not making any admissions during that first interview. Fourth, as the trial court suggested, Captain Matthew was not role-playing friendship with Mr. Hoppy, as opposed to genuinely being, quoting the trial court here, uncommonly helpful to Mr. Hoppy during the course of the interviews. They had known each other for 25 years. Fifth, as the trial court found, Captain Matthew did not employ deceit to coerce admissions from Mr. Hoppy. As the Court of Appeals noted, the trial court expressly rejected, I see I'm not going to be able to get to all of them if I just may finish this one sentence. As the Court of Appeals noted, the trial court expressly rejected Mr. Hoppy's protest that Captain Matthew had lied to him. There was information in the record that suggested the death had occurred prior to the date on which Mr. Hoppy claimed to have discovered the body. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farmuth. Thank you, Mr. Small, for your arguments today in 00.